Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me, as he's given me company for most part of this series, Brother Harishankar from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. And we are finally here at the last episode of Season 2 of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. For those of you who have been kind enough to be with us all through this season, we'll probably start with a big thank you to all of you for joining us, because it's because of listeners that we are able to go deep into these discourses, and as a part of sharing it with you, I think we are the first beneficiaries. So a big thank you to all of you. The 1991 Samuko series is what we have completed, and we started a session of summaries last week. We're going to continue that this week. We spoke about, I think, the first seven discourses. That Swami covered. We'll continue from there. Just like what we did last week, it's not going to be a comprehensive summary of each discourse, but we're going to pick out some highlight points from each of those discourses which were standouts, which were very important, which had very important take-home lessons, and which was striking even as we were going through the discourse. We hope it's certainly worthwhile to remember much of the discourse, but at least these points, to remember them again is fruitful for all of us. So with offering our loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, for one last time in Season 2 of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam, let's invite Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem.
And the two series that we've done, 1990 and 1991, it's so different in many ways. One is 1994 was in many ways a startup course for spirituality. You know, it gave a very beautiful and comprehensive idea of what do we mean by being spiritual? What do you do with the senses? What do you do with the mind? What do you do with the actions that you have? And as you very beautifully pointed out last time, the 1991 series goes a step deeper. It doesn't talk about just the mind and the senses, but it talks about something higher than just being good, just being just doing the right things at the right time. That's, of course, the starting point for spirituality. As well, Swami beautifully said in one of the discourses that we went through, guilelessness is a necessary basis for spiritual growth itself. But there is something beyond that. In fact, we were, I think, at the point of that discourse, in the eighth discourse, where Swami refers to this, right? I think it's in this discourse that Swami speaks about the four types of human beings,
yes.
Right? So you'd like to take one from there?
Yeah.
Or something other than that, of course, you can.
No, I was just also saying that it is a complete immersion into the main Upanishads, where essentially dwelling on what is a person. Right, and if I remember in the 1990 discourse, we talked about the gunas, and
right.
We did dwell a little bit on the pranas, and you know, their functions, etc. But here we are going very deep into what each of the Upanishads they speak about, right? And we are at the Prashnopanishad, the eighth discourse. That last time we did the first seven, right? And here we are at the eighth discourse, which answers some of the questions which are raised by the students of Sage Pipilada. And the question that is asked, the ones that Swami deals with in this discourse, were with the disciple asked the sage that when a person sleeps, who is it that sleeps?
Right.
And who is it that dreams? And who is it that is awake during this whole time? Because
right.
There is like some person that is present throughout, and what is that person that is awake? And so the detailed answer follows in that Upanishad, in which essentially they say that it is the five pranas that are awake the whole time.
Right.
And as we spoke that time, that very beautiful analogy of a village
with
five fires. What?
Right.
I mean, like, it's so evocative, you know.
Right.
So, and Swami, in fact, he mentions specifically that the function of samana is responsible for inhalation, exhalation. The last time we saw that udana is the one, the prana that carried the record of actions
right.
to the following birth, etc. But in this discourse, essentially, Swami speaks about the om, the pranava, Right. And the same theme, you know, like now with hindsight, we can see how Swami was again and again distinguishing between the objects of sadhana when we perform it. Like there can be one object is like worldly pursuits, or let's say just the, you know, our kith and kin should be prosperous, they should be safe and healthy. That's definitely a noble thing to pray for, or understandable thing to pray for. And so Swami says that in when you say Om, that you can have that, when you meditate on that, you can have this as one of the objectives, and certainly you'll reach it. And then we have, you know, Swami says the Chandra Loka, which Swami had spoken about, where if you chant Om, knowing the significance of Om.
Right.
And Swami says that then you'll attain the Chandra Loka.
Which is akin where to these, the heaven. Right.
Sorry?
Which is akin to heaven.
Yeah, akin to heaven, where you enjoy the merits of whatever you accrued, you know, but at the end of it you come back. But Swami says the highest sadhana is when you chant Om just for the sake of God itself. And Swami says that is when you go to the Suvar Loka, so the Surya Loka, right? So Swami is distinguishing between again essentially the types of sadhana or the objects of sadhana. So while speaking about the importance of Om in the discourse.
Right.
And because the pranava or the Om is actually, we see it being praised a lot in the Chandogya Upanishad. Mm-hmm. So in the Samaveda they refer to it as the Udgita.
Right.
So that is praised a lot in the large section of the Chandogya Upanishad, which is dedicated to the praise of Om itself.
I think in one other Samukho series, if I'm not wrong, the 93, there's an entire discourse on the Omkara, I think, where Swami speaks about the Samaveda and the importance it gives to the pranava. But very similar to the earlier discourse where Swami spoke about Uttarayana and Dakshinayana.
Yes.
And, you know, any act which is performed with the benefits in mind, even if it's a good act, it can only take you up till the level of heaven where you enjoy. And Swami gave that very graphic example of a parliamentarian being elected to be a member of the parliament.
Mm.
They said you live out that 5 years or the term which
tenure
you're allowed to be there, and then you have to come back and then you have to rework your way into that position again. And the same thing Swami says about the pranava. And I think it's true for everything. You know, even if you talk about education, which is again something which Swami spoke of in one of these discourses, the importance to go beyond bookish knowledge, the importance to talk about wisdom, and the importance of using that wisdom for the benefit of society.
Yeah.
It's like that, you know, you could go to school with the idea of getting good marks in your exam. And if you have that as your goal and if you work, I think you will get there. But that's all you will get. But the moment you expand your scope and you say, no, I want to learn something new and I want to expand my knowledge, and that will happen. You know, yes, the exam part is also taken care of and you will also learn more. But Swami says the moment you start saying that I want to learn and I want to use this for the benefit of somebody, the gains that you get in that is multifold compared to just studying for an exam, studying for marks. And that's the same thing with spirituality itself. And I think in some other context also Swami makes this point. That is why devotion becomes so much more higher, because automatically you do it just out of the joy of taking the Lord's name, just out of the joy of serving, pleasing the Lord. So the idea of gaining something from it is removed from the equation at the outset itself.
Yes. Even in the last discourse you were seeing, you know, that when the student asks, how do we get out of the cycle of life and of birth and death? Ultimately, the sage speaks about how you can, you know, do different acts and attain different lokas. But ultimately, the cycle will continue. And so he says that the only resort is devotion.
Right.
That will burn away, you know, the whole accumulated whatever, like the balance of whatever is there.
Right.
And here, actually, Swami also speaks about the Hiranyagarbha for in detail.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami's, while describing the Hiranyagarbha, he has, of course, we'll go into more detail in the following discourses.
Right.
But over here, one important point he makes is that the nature of man is to be selfish. Mm-hmm. Swami says that that is your nature. As a man, you're going to be selfish. So he says that therefore direct your selfishness in such a way that you attain to this Hiranyagarbha state. That is, you should be seeking, you know, when you're seeking something for yourself, seek the highest.
Right.
Seek the divinity, seek the brightness which is within you. You be selfish for that. You know that I want this.
Right.
You know that if you are selfish, direct it towards that. And also Swami makes this point, you know, very beautiful point, which we go into detail again in the next discourse. But Swami says that a person who is in the Sushupti state is referred to in the Vedas as the Hiranyagarbha.
Right.
You know, that when that bright golden, that is a very beautiful thing which, you know, is very elevating to hear when Swami says that when we take ourselves to be such ordinary people, but when the Vedas are constantly reminding you that you at all times you are that divinity. And the Hiranyagarbha essentially, it represents that potential, you know,
right,
of the possibility of different possibilities.
Exactly.
That is the Hiranyagarbha.
Right. As you're saying, in a later discourse, Swami gives a very beautiful description of Hiranyagarbha, contrasting it with this one. I think we'll come to that when we come to that discourse.
Yeah.
The other thing which Swami spoke of in this is from Hiranyagarbha, of course, he takes it on to the idea of the spiritual heart and then the difference between science and spirituality. I think that is something which repeats again in the other discourses in a different context. But as you're saying, the idea of this discourse, central idea is the intention with which you pursue anything in the context of Pranava, Swami speaks of it. But the idea is when you are able to purify your intention, the distance you will travel actually gets magnified as much. If you're thinking of short-term goals, that's what you will get. If you're thinking of long-term goals, then that's where you will be heading towards. The next discourse also is a continuation on the Prashna Upanishad. I think this is the third one, right?
Yeah, and the final answer, there were six questions that are asked in the Prashna Upanishad, and this deals with the sixth question.
Right.
And this is one of the most profound questions because the question is asking about the Purusha. So they have heard about the Purusha in various contexts it is described, the Purusha Sukta or the different descriptions are there of the Purusha. So the disciple goes to the sage Pippilada and asks him, what is this Purusha that is spoken about? So the discourse actually deals a lot with the Purushottama, but Swami continues on actually at the beginning of the discourse with the Pranava principle.
Right.
And so Swami again, you know, the same theme, what we spoke about Om in the previous discourse, again Swami repeats it in a different way, and Swami speaks about the three different kinds of sadhanas that we undertake or spiritual paths that are there in front of a devotee. Right? One is the path of namasmarana, Swami says. And then there is bhavam, the feeling of devotion, the feeling of kinship with the Lord, etc. And then there is the sadhana which we do. And Swami says that how, you know, if, we get for each one of these sadhanas that we undertake, there are the worldly pleasures that we get. And then how Swami says through devotion, you can attain that Chandra Loka actually.
Right.
But he says finally if you want to attain Surya Loka, which is our ultimate permanent goal, Swami says that you should undertake sadhana, that the sadhana of who are you should inquire. And this kind of sadhana, Swami says, is actually what will finally take you to the goal.
Right.
So that is how Swami begins the discourse.
Right.
But the crux of it is essentially Swami uses to speak to us about the Purusha. And the reason for that is, we'll see later, but Swami dwells in detail as to what is this, the Purusha, and with the 16 kalas that the Purusha possesses. So in detail it is mentioned that these are the five elements, then the five pranas, and the karmendriyas and jnanendriyas, which are five in number, and finally the mind itself. So in great, the Purusha itself is praised, right? Even in the Purusha Suktam, they say that essentially this is what the cosmic body itself, right? And that it speaks about the sacrifice of the cosmic body for the universe, right? And so Swami says that essentially this is who you are. This is what a person is like.
Right.
This is, and from there, you know, once we are reminded of actually who we truly are, which is actually the message of the Upanishads, the theme of the Upanishads. From there, Swami launches on to why, therefore, you should use your senses and your mind, you know, in the most appropriate manner. So Swami goes in detail, you know, each sense. Like Swami says, if it is the eyes, then you should make use of the eyes to see divinity everywhere. And if it is hearing, make sure that what you hear is something that keeps reminding you of your own divinity. He says that is the proper use of the senses. In various places Swami speaks about like hands, how they have to be, how you have to use them for service, etc. So that is a beautiful build up that Swami gives, you know. It's not an empty talk about some abstract concept called the Purusha, which is in the Vedas. Swami uses that to remind that this being who you truly are. Therefore, the best use of your senses is in this way. It's not an admonition of any sort or just, you know, directing you. It's like saying, this is who you are.
Right.
And hence you should behave this way.
It's almost suggesting that you raise to your potential. Because what Swami is saying is,
yes,
as you were saying, talking about the 16 attributes, and Swami did not say that the perfect Purusha has all these 16 attributes and you don't have. Swami is saying the same 16 attributes which are there in the Purusha is there in each individual, but it is not completely utilized or blossomed to that absolute potential.
Yes.
And then Swami makes this, in a summary of all of that, as you're saying, Swami broke it down and said what you do with the Karmendriyas, what you do with the Jnanendriyas. But to sum it all up, you know, Swami talks about the avatar, the nature of an avatar, and he says, from there, how do you learn? He says, you know, only the avatars can apply the 16 attributes with total unalloyed selflessness.
Exactly.
Whatever is done, seen, spoken, or taught by avatars is absolute selflessness. And there, Swami is suggesting that this is all that you need to do.
Yeah.
If you're able to use each one of these 16 attributes with as much selflessness as you can muster, then you are on the path to manifesting that Purusha from within.
Yes. And that is the purpose of an avatar, no? God takes human birth to show how man himself can ascend to that divinity.
Right.
And so Swami very emphatically says that no avatar has used their senses ever for selfish ends. And as you rightly said, no, this Swami very clearly he says that the 16 attributes are present in you. Right, but they have to be sanctified, and they are sanctified only when they are in the service of the self itself. Because when we talk about the 16 attributes, the last attribute is the mind, and very noticeably absent is the Atma. See, normally you would say the Purusha is this, 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 and the 16th element you would have anticipated it to be the Atma. Swami keeps that out of the equation and says that unless all of these are dedicated to the service of the Atma, till such time you are not satisfying your true potential, you are not living as the Purusha.
Right. And I think the later part of the same discourse, the ninth discourse, is the Mundaka Upanishad and the Brahma Vidya.
Yeah.
As from the very practical idea of how do you use all these implements which constitute an individual, Swami goes on to that, a beautiful conversation. This time a question posed to sage Angirasa, where I don't know who is the one who is asking this question. Shaunaka, Swami says, Shaunaka asks Angirasa this question that what is that one thing knowing which you know everything? And
right.
I think this is a certain kind of a question which repeats in many, many Upanishads.
Yeah.
And we even speak of the conversation between Uddalaka and Shvetaketu where a similar question arises. And then he says Angirasa gives the same thing what Swami told till now in this discourse. He says that knowledge of the Atma is the only thing which can give you that.
Right, but interestingly, in this discourse, when you go to the Mundaka Upanishad, the Shaunaka is a householder. Whereas
exactly,
in the earlier case, they were all well-versed. They're already well-versed in Vedanta.
Right.
And they're pretty much at the graduation stage, they come and speak to sage Pipilada. But here, the Shaunaka is described as a householder but was done like extensive acts of service and charity to merit that proximity to sage Angirasa.
Right. And that's where the tone of this conversation is a little different. As I think even when we were going through this discourse, you made that point very beautifully, where this is how you need to look at this conversation itself, how it is different from the conversation between Pipilada and his disciples. Because this is something which we can relate more to. And It's almost the same thing. It's about the same 16 colors and how do you use them, and how that is applicable, more applicable to somebody who is in the world today.
Right.
You know, you have to find a process of sublimating them through the usage of them,
correct,
not through the avoiding the usage of them is not the path for somebody in the society.
Correct. Because Swami, at the very beginning, he speaks about the sage Angirasa. He says that this is not the physical sage that we are talking about. Angirasa means what? So he says when he's speaking about the Shodasha Kala Paripurna, you know, that Purusha, Angirasa is something that animates, it flows through all of this and animates it. And hence, that Angirasa is the Prajnana itself, it is awareness itself that is speaking to that person whom we are referring as Shaunaka. And of course, Swami at this stage in the discourse, we see that he is mentioning the four Mahavakyas of the Upanishads. So Swami speaks about the Tattvamasi, Prajnanam Brahma, which, so when he said Prajnanam, so Swami speaks about this is what the Upanishads speak about. And I am Atma Brahma, that is, I am Atma and I am Brahma, and Aham Brahmasmi. Right? These are the four Mahavakyas that come through from the various Upanishads. They are not present in the Mundaka Upanishad, but across the principal Upanishads at various places we find these are the Mahavakyas that come through. And so Swami, like as I said, no, this is for a householder, so or a person of the world. And Swami reminds him of what the word Akshara means. So Swami says that Akshara, it's not that which is imperishable, but both. It contains within itself that which can perish as well as the imperishable. And here Swami, you know, very nicely, he says, you know, just as you have this pair of the perishable and the imperishable, you also have the pair of the God and devotee.
Right.
And Swami says that it is the devotion of the devotee that it intensifies to such an extent that love takes form. It says that Sakshatkara is essentially that love taking form as God itself. So in a sense, Swami says that it is the devotee that creates the God when that love intensifies so much. And so Swami gives that context for what Sakshatkara is.
Right.
So,
and just like how we mentioned about God and devotee and the perishable and the imperishable, Swami in the same vein goes on to speak about theism and atheism. Where Swami says that even an atheist actually is a believer, but who denies belief.
Right.
And you can deny only which is already there.
Existing.
And Swami gives a beautiful analogy of the atheist being a bud, whereas the theist being a blossomed flower.
Right.
He says that even the one who refuses to acknowledge the presence of God is just not there yet.
Yeah,
something like what Swami would say about communists.
Exactly.
Right?
Communists.
Swami would say communists are communext. They will eventually come around. But very beautifully, I think this part of that discourse was, in essence, what the Upanishads say, that within the destructible is the indestructible, and within the individual is the divine, within the mortal is the immortal.
Right.
And within this belief is the real belief. So it is all about trying to bring out from within, and which is the essence of the Upanishads itself, juxtaposed to what modern learning or modern education is, where you gather from outside, you gather knowledge. Not to dismiss that as unimportant, but with the understanding that, you know, that is for a certain, which Swami would always say, that is for secular learning, that is needed for the world outside. But the whole idea should be to manifest this knowledge from within at some point in time. And the whole process is to help you in that.
Yes. And that's why Swami, you know, one of the themes that he speaks about over here is the three kinds of knowledge. Swami delineates. Again, this is very true for a worldly person, right? For us, those of us who are in the world, we need to know or distinguish between these three kinds. And so we have Swami speaking about jnana, sugjnana and vijnana as the three kinds of knowledge that are there. And moving on, I've already gone towards the end of the discourse, but if there's anything you would like to delineate me.
Right, I think that's pretty much, especially that last part where Swami spoke about the three types of knowledge.
Right.
I think it's worth emphasizing that whenever Swami speaks about these three types of knowledge, I think in a later discourse also Swami makes a mention of it. Swami never says don't pursue worldly education, don't pursue that knowledge which gives you an idea of right and wrong.
Right.
Because even when he was talking about Sugjnana, Vijnana, Swami says that knowledge which helps you distinguish between objects, you know, when you want to do something, that practical knowledge is very, very important. But it's just that the compass should be the deeper knowledge. That's
right.
What Swami says. I think that's something which we always have to keep in mind.
And towards the end, actually, there's a very beautiful gem of, you know, what Swami speaks about. The Swami says that this is, he's narrating a conversation between the Gopikas and Lord Krishna, and you know, they are trying to gather his form in, or see his form in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that, Lord, your form is dark. You know, Krishna is envisioned as a dark form.
Right.
And the word Krishna itself means dark. And the pupils, our pupils are also dark, and we are trying to reflect you, right, in that, in our eyes. And so they say that even the sky, the blue sky, if it is a dark lake, it will appear dark in that sky. So here Swami makes a very beautiful point. He says that what the Gopikas are saying is that we don't need to change, you know, either the you know, person, the physically, nothing has to change. And in the mind also nothing has to change. But they say, the Gopikas go on to say that if we just make the sky white, if we make the background white, that's all needs to change. And you will be seen in our eyes. So Swami is saying that what you cannot change your mind. You know, that people have been trying for ages and have been failing in that respect.
Mm.
Physically nothing has to change. It really doesn't matter who you are physically. But if you can identify with your heart, you know, if you can change your heart and identify, what it means is, of course, identify with the divinity. When you say heart, that identify with the divine, says that is when you become, you know, that is when the Lord can be seen in you.
Right.
And then Swami gives that other example, you know.
Beautiful
that,
example, right.
Yeah, of charcoal. Like how can you make charcoal white? So normally we try to, you know, wash it. And Swami says that if you wash it with milk, even that white milk may turn black. However, the charcoal remains what it is. So he says you have to burn it in the devotion to the Lord, or burn it with the Lord's grace, the power of the Lord's grace. And when you burn charcoal, when you, he says, Swami actually says in detail, you burn wood and it becomes black charcoal. So again, you have to take the charcoal and put it back in the fire and have it burn more and more.
Right.
Till such time it becomes ash, and at that time it becomes this white vibhuti. Very beautiful, right.
Very beautiful. And
analogy.
You know, Swami goes on to explain that. He says you put charcoal in the fire, and when that whiteness is not coming, you pull it out of the charcoal, out of the fire, which is exactly the thing you're not supposed to do.
Yes, yes.
Swami saying that even though it is not showing up as whiteness at that moment,
yes,
the way forward is to make it remain in that fire for longer. And Swami beautifully gives that analogy of same is the case with devotion. In the process of devotion, sometimes there is pain, sometimes the flaws within you start coming out.
Right.
At that moment, you don't withdraw from God or withdraw from devotional activities, but you plunge yourself furthermore till the point where that whiteness comes as a blessing. Swami saying that it will be given to you at a certain point after this process. And I think that is the ninth discourse in that series. The tenth one, of course, is about the Taittiriya Upanishad. And the Taittiriya Upanishad, of course, we know is very, very closely relatable to the process of education itself. Because the Taittiriya Upanishad, the first part of Taittiriya Upanishad is the Shikshavali, right? If I'm
We have
mistaken.
Shikshavali, the Anandavali,
and the Bhrigavali. Right.
These are the three the mantras that form part of the Taittiriya Upanishad. And of course, Shikshavali is one of the most important, because here Swami speaks about the very, you know, concluding paragraphs of the Upanishads, of the Taittiriya Upanishad, you know, where Swami speaks about the injunctions that the Upanishad gives, no, to the student, so who is concluding his study. So speak the truth, you know, Satyam Vada, Dharmam Chara, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Swami says that this is one of the messages that the students get at the end of the Upanishad. In detail, Swami speaks about the five fires, which is, actually we see this in the Chandogya Upanishad, there's the or in various places actually, we find mentions of the five fires, and Swami speaks about them. Because you were mentioning, you know, in the previous, at the conclusion of the previous discourse, Swami was speaking about the importance of staying even when it begins to feel uncomfortable, which is putting it very lightly, you know, when sadhana starts, actually you go through such upheavals that at that stage you want to just drop off from the whole thing, right?
Right.
But, so Swami is speaking about the different, the sufferings that a person undergoes in the world. So Swami first speaks about, at the physical level, you have the Udaragni and the Mandagni, which is the, you know, the craving for food, is the Udaragni, and then you have Mandagni, which is the exact, you know, overcompensation. That is when you have overeaten and the suffering you undergo through that.
Right.
Which is, of course, talks about all the senses, not just food that is mentioned here, but the suffering that you overindulge in any kind of senses, and you pay the price for that. Then Swami speaks about Kamagni and the Shokagni, again the opposites, where at the mental level you crave for something, and then when that desire is unfulfilled, you immerse yourself in Shokagni. You start feeling sorrow that your desires have gone unfulfilled. And Swami again makes the point over here that Shoka, you know, that pining and all that should be directed towards God. You should feel unhappy that you haven't attained God. No, that is a shoka which I think all of us can very easily identify at that physical level. So Swami used to take us through that. You know, and that Agni, we have to undergo that suffering. That is a given. But Swami used to alleviate that suffering such that suffering is for God.
Right.
And finally, we have Badabhagni, which is the which happens due to so many factors: disease, worry, death. And Swami makes a very beautiful point that all this suffering which you are speaking about pertains only to the person and not to the Atma. The Atma, the self, remains unaffected throughout. No matter what no matter what suffering he or she is undergoing, the Atma is above all that. It's just a pure witness or even beyond.
Right.
You know, it's not involved with any of that.
Talking about that Shokagni, Swami made a very beautiful point. Swami made a reference to the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita where Swami was talking about Arjuna Vishada Yoga.
Correct.
He said that it's entirely about this Shoka which Arjuna was facing. And then Swami raises this point, why was it given the title Yoga?
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking of Shokagni as one of the effects which the body undergoes,
right,
and it is spoken of as something which is not so noble. So Swami is saying, why is Arjuna's worry given that title of Yoga? And that's why Swami reiterated that point which you were saying, that his Shoka was not about killing others, it was not about his attachment. Though it was based on his attachment, the basic dilemma was, what is right? What is my duty towards God? I think that's what Swami says. Arjuna was worried about what is his duty towards God. And Swami says, that is what made that Shokagni so noble that it could be even called as a yoga.
Right.
And that's what Swami is saying, that if you're able to direct all of these things for that nobler, more noble purpose, and then you will be able to proceed. That's exactly what Swami was telling about that analogy of that coal and fire and the ability to go that entire distance. And in that same context, flowing from that idea, Swami speaks about this very, very fascinating idea. When we were going through it, we were so thrilled about it.
Yeah.
The four types of human beings, suggesting that, you know, in the process of transformation, you could be in the first or second level, but you can't stop there. You'll have to go till that last level, which is the divine human being.
Yeah.
Right.
So Swami spoke about those four. So I'll talk about in ascending order. Like, so Swami first talks about the animal person, like the like a beast, right? Which is the basest form of existence. And next Swami speaks about the Danava Manava, that is a demonic person. And Swami says that this is a person who has absolutely no love, completely given to the vices and all the physical pleasures, etc. Right? And then you have what Swami calls as a Manava Manava, which is like, now, we would think that we are somewhere here, but when you read the description, he's speaking about a very noble person.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Completely full of virtues, given to charity and all the best virtues that you can speak about, and that is a Manava Manava. So, like, we are at some end of the spectrum there. And finally, Swami says the Daiva Manava. So, that is actually the avatar itself. That when the God takes human form, that is what it embodies, the absolute perfection of what a human being can be. With all, you can see that every action is there, you know, the acts of love, charity, compassion, but with complete selflessness. There's still the distinction between Manava Manava and the Daiva Manava is that element of ego or selfishness that is present, that is not there in the Daiva Manava. But what thrilled me at that time was that all of these are in a sense simultaneously, you know, jostling for attention within each one of us, right? There are elements of everything. And finally, it is up to us which one we want to feed or foster.
Right.
So, instead of like it being through stages, like at the same time, that tasmat jagrata jagrata principle of the Upanishads, that if you do not, if you're not disciplined, you're not vigilant, you're going to slip back into one of the lower forms of existence.
Exactly. And even the Deva Manava which Swami spoke of, Swami started off by referring to that as the state an avatar is in, but Swami speaks of how even through devotion you can get there.
Right.
Where Swami is saying that you do all these acts, good actions, you do dharmic actions, you do charity, all of that. But when all of that is done out of love for God, then you go to that stage of the divine human being or the, you know, similarly that very, very small difference between the animal human and the demonic human, or rather the, you know, because we don't know how that is differentiated. Swami is saying that the animal human is a self-centered human being where, you know, all his decisions is based on what can I get from there.
Yep.
But the demonic is again a self-centered human being, but self-centered to such an extent that he does not mind harming the others to satisfy his own needs.
Right.
Swami is saying when that happens, you become a Danava Manava, and Swami in fact says that probably that's where most of us are, because we are in a state where we don't mind utilizing all our knowledge, all our skills. Even if it hurts the other person, as far as it satisfies me, I don't mind going. And as you pointed out, the whole journey is to try to suppress the three of the others which are there. First of all, try to achieve the second last stage of the human, because the human values is all about that, and then strive to go beyond that to the state of the divine human.
Because Swami observes that the present state of society where we are is because the world has no human values, and that is because we have violated the dharma, in the sense Swami says we have stooped down, you know, to the demonic or animal levels, and he says that in itself is a violation of dharma.
Right.
So when you are the human and you behave like at lower levels, he says that itself is a violation of dharma. And then Swami goes on to speak about the distinction between Shreyas and Priyas, which is quite relevant, you know, when we want to move on to the higher levels, you know, when you want to become a person who is given to service of people, who is with love and compassion, there's no escaping this distinction between what is Shreyas and what is Priyas. Essentially, like, Shreyas has to do with actions which grant happiness in the long term, right? Postpone. So prayers is that which is, you can talk about instant gratification or sensual gratification, what we seek for selfish reasons, etc. So these are all, you know, we are geared towards getting that happiness in the immediate. But if we can set that aside and look for the higher desires, you know, the desires for the society at large, or, you know, much larger, praying for the progress of the world, etc., and basically keep this aside, you know, become a person who is of service to society, that is Shreyas.
Right.
Right. So that, I thought that Swami so beautifully puts that in context. Right. Right?
Yeah. And this whole thing really fits into that Sikshavali section of Taittiriya Upanishad. Because Swami says that these were the kind of advices which were given to students who were graduating. And this is again is the one which Swami would ask the students to chant even during our convocation.
Mm.
Right? Because Swami would say that you've been given all the skills necessary to live your life, and then you are given this this precept about choosing the Shreyas over prayers and all of this, and then you're allowed to go into the world. And this is again the point where Swami mentioned that don't give up practical knowledge. Pursue it with determination, but at the same time, constantly ask yourself, how am I going to use this in the service of the society I'm living in?
Right.
I think this is pretty much the essence of the discourse, the 11th discourse. We'll go to the 13th discourse. The 13th and the 14th, the second last and the last one, were a little more general, which were not...
No, we had this discourse where Swami speaks about the Virat Purusha,
exactly,
the Hiranyagarbha,
right,
and the Avyakrita, the three forms of God. And I think without bias towards all the discourses, but somehow this one discourse, it for me conveyed a lot. It was very weighty and it had a lot of messages. But very primarily speaking, this is from the Mandukya Upanishad, which is again one of the, they say for a spiritual seeker, it is one of the most important Upanishads. So it speaks about how we have the different stages of existence. You have the waking state, you have the dream state, and you have the deep sleep state. And the Upanishads, they talk about how there is divinity or God, how in different forms is present in each one of these.
Right.
You have in the physical state, you have the Virat Purusha. And Swami spoke about in deep sleep, in the state of dreams, dream. You have the Hiranyagarbha, the Lord is present as Hiranyagarbha. And when you have gone beyond into deep sleep, when there is no sense of a person as such, and at that stage, the Lord is present as Avyakrita. And one of the very beautiful messages which comes through in the Mandukya Upanishad at this stage is where it conveys the name as Ishvara. At that stage, right. When you are in deep sleep and you are no longer that, although you are consciousness, but you have now gone into the undifferentiated consciousness.
Right.
There is no person who is either watching the dream, waking dream or the sleeping dream. At that point, it conveys the title of Ishvara.
Right.
And that is such an elevating, that you are the Lord yourself. At that moment, when you are completely bereft of all this sense of I, you are transformed into the Lord Himself.
Right.
And that Lord, the word Ishvara means the person that confers Aishwarya, that confers prosperity, etc. to the person. So you have become that person.
Right.
And Hiranyagarbha, as Swami said, it is basically the potential of all the possibilities that can happen.
Right. I mean, as you're saying, this is probably one of the most interesting discourses in that series, though it's whether we are right to say that or not is not, I'm not sure. But it was really an eye-opener, because we hear of all of these different forms of God, but Swami so clearly said the correlation between the God who is manifest, the God who can manifest, and the God who is beyond manifestation at all.
Yes.
Where Swami is saying that when you see different forms, Swami was referring to the Purusha Suktam, he says, when you say Sahasra Shirsha Purusha, which means God is already manifested, and that is what we refer to as the Virata Swarupa. God in that stage is called Virata. But in this dream state, Swami was saying that in the dream state, there is no limitation of time and space. And that is the Hiranyagarbha aspect of the unmanifest God. And Swami was telling that pertains to the mind.
Right.
The at the thought level is what the Lord is present in the form of Hiranyagarbha and the deep sleep state. And then I think Swami went on to that beautiful point where he said, when God manifests, how he has to go through the four rules,
right,
of karma, kartavya,
kala, karma, karana and kartavya. Again, a very beautiful point, right, over there. Because it's like in the physical world, these are the boundaries or the perimeters within which,
right,
you have to operate.
Right.
Take you to that heights and then bring you down to ground reality, because right, that is inescapable.
You cannot overlook that.
Right. Then Swami, at some point of time over here, he speaks about some of the concepts that we spoke about earlier, that what is the significance of the sun, etc. But towards the end of the discourse, I think one of the most important things he brings about at this stage is the responsibility of mothers in inculcating these principles, right? So he gives various examples of how Arjuna's wife Subhadra, or the mother of Abhimanyu, and of Queen Leelavati, who is the mother of Prahlada, and how, while she was in the womb, it was the sage Narada who spoke to her about Lord Narayana. So Swami is saying that as a mother, while she was listening to the beautiful story of the Lord, etc., the beneficiary, biggest beneficiary was the son who was present in the womb. So saying, in effect, saying that a mother should always be thinking like good thoughts, especially when she is carrying the child, etc. But one of the biggest, Swami has always emphasized that it is the mother's role which is primary in creating the noble or model citizens of this country. That is, I think, as we said, every discourse is a mixture of the profound as well as what we would normally take as mundane. But they're actually the effect or the practice of what is spoken about in the discourse, and may sometimes be more difficult to follow.
And the next discourse which followed, which was about sadhana, was actually a very, once again, enlightening discourse in that sense, where Swami redefined sadhana. Swami was saying that people do all kinds of sadhana, but they don't see progress.
Yeah.
And Swami explained that is because you don't understand what sadhana is. Only if you understand, you will look into yourself and see that if that change is happening, if it is not happening, what is there to be done. And Swami explained that sadhana is the transformation from bad to good, converting sorrow into happiness.
Right.
And Swami went on to say, how you do that? One of the most striking points that hit me when we were going through that discourse is when Swami was saying that the first point is to accept sorrow. Don't, repel from sorrow, but you accept sorrow. Only in the form of acceptance you can actually transform that sorrow also to your benefit. So Swami is talking about why that acceptance of suffering is important. Swami gave the examples of the devotees who would accept the suffering as a means of going closer to God. Swami spoke of that. And the other tool which Swami gave was try and strike that balance between self-confidence and ego. That is one more thing which is very essential in the spiritual sadhana that one undertakes. Then the importance of seva, Swami spoke, how it inculcates selflessness and why to be able to be, to go out there and use your body in the service of others is a very important aspect of sadhana. Then Swami spoke about one of the best ways to control the mind. Swami said, always move about with the fear of sin, with the love for God, and with what is the morality which is necessary in society.
Right. And I think as we remember in that discourse, you know, Swami went through those several stages of our existence, you know, the physical and then the mental. And finally, Swami goes into the Atma itself, at the, you know, right, transcending all of this. Because when we speak about sorrow, that is at the mental stage. And, you know, so finally, Swami gives the example of Adi Shankara, who, you know, while walking with his disciples, at one point of time, he's confronted by a chandala, like,
right,
and a person of the lower caste. And when he asks him to move away, he reminds him of who, you know, that who should move away? Should the body move away? I am not that body. And should the Atma move away? And that does not move anywhere. It is present everywhere. It can't move at all. So that's when Adi Shankara gets a jolt, you know, that all these things he has suddenly forgotten, these principles. So that's when the moment he realizes that, and he realizes the person is nobody ordinary, that person appears in front of him. So that was a very beautiful story. Exactly. By which one more thing is that how alert one should be, that even somebody like Adi Shankaracharya can slip into forgetfulness. So most important is that ability to remain. But I think the biggest takeaway certainly from that discourse was, what is sadhana?
Right. What,
you know,
is sadhana?
Which, yeah, converting bad into good, and into good, yeah, right, sorrow into this. So yeah,
right,
you were saying.
I think that's pretty much the discourse. And one more beautiful thing in that discourse is in the end, when Swami was talking about how do you sanctify time? You know, what makes a day meaningful?
The
beautiful padyam that Swami sang. He said, you know, the day when true devotees gather and remember God with music, that is a meaningful day. The day when you assuage the grief of the poor and treat them as your brothers with love. The day when you contemplate on God and feed your servants with tasty food. The day when great persons come into your midst and regale us with stories of the Lord. Swami says such days are the true days. Swami doesn't even say that they're meaningful days. These are the days. Other days are, you know, equal to dead days. That's what Swami said. The last discourse, of course, we've covered it recently. We might not need to summarize so much. But in essence, that discourse was all about dharma and dharma's important role and how dharma is so very native to the idea of Indian culture itself, because the entire series is summer course on Indian culture and spirituality. So that it's so befitting that the last discourse is about dharma. And I recall we shared that incident when Swami was asked to give a name which is representative of Indian culture. Swami said there's only one name which can represent Indian culture, and that is dharma. And that's what Swami spoke of in this entire discourse, of how you're saying that every epic actually was trying to portray righteousness.
Right.
The person who is righteous actually might be poorer than the rest, maybe weaker than the rest, but that person was being held out as an example because dharma was the one which needed to be highlighted. And then Swami was speaking of how dharma is an intrinsic nature of human being, just like the nature of fire is to burn, the nature of water is to wet and to flow. The nature of a human being is to be dharmic. And Swami was saying that all of this, it's the idea of the Upanishads, the way they train your mind, the way they make you pursue spirituality, should eventually manifest as dharma. Which, going back to that, the three forms of divinity which we spoke of, Swami again comes to karma, kala, karana and kartavya. And to be able to go through this entire maze doing the right thing at every moment is what dharma is about, and all of Upanishad is meant to give you that knowledge to go through this maze without getting attached anywhere, at the same time keeping your mind focused on the ultimate goal, not the immediate goal, and to ensure that you transcend all of this.
Exactly, because Swami reminds us of this when he speaks about the Manu Dharma. So the Manu Dharma, right, essentially the while a distillation of several Dharma Shastras, but it lays down that the object of Dharma is not as, it's not meant as punishment and reward. It is more essentially a form of sadhana. That when you practice this path of Dharma, the ultimate goal that is reaching and that is waiting for you is realization itself.
Right.
So it is given as a, and that's why Swami says that Nietzsche, the philosopher, German, right, philosopher Nietzsche, he held this code of conduct, so to speak, dharmic code, as being like far superior to anything that
ethical code
he had, yeah, anything that he had encountered. Mm-hmm. And Swami moves on to give the example of Prahlada. Over right, here,
that's, I think, a brilliant example.
Yeah, right. I think what I took away from that particular episode, we all know the story of the tribulations through which his own father put him for the, because while Hiranyakashipu thought that he is the Lord himself, his own son would believe that there is somebody called Lord Narayana who is the Lord.
Mm.
And while quizzing his son and putting him through so much tribulations, like Swami, of course, we all know how the story ends, but the most important thing I think Swami emphasized that how his son, when he watches his son go through all that, like that he's he doesn't drown in water, that he's not consumed by fire, and at that point of time it starts kindling in him an understanding, right, of who a person truly is,
right,
and that culminates in the breaking apart of the pillar. It, Swami, right, says actually the breaking apart of the consciousness, the body consciousness, yeah, of Hiranyakashipu, who at that time has the vision of the Lord. So, right, his son kind of prepares the pathway for him to reach the,
exactly,
Lord.
I mean, that's a very beautiful point that Swami mentioned there, because Swami always talks of Hiranyakashipu as a scientist, as somebody who is keenly looking at, yeah, things and trying to discern what they are suggesting. And Swami says, as a culmination literally of that true exploration, you know, eventually when he breaks that pillar of body consciousness, he has the sakshatkar. And from there on, Swami speaks about how name and form is intrinsically attached, connected. How through the name you can reach out to the form. That was the later part of that discourse. And I think that was the concluding idea as such, one of the important things which Swami left with, of how devotion is important and how that devotion should express itself as the virtues in people. And again, Swami ended with emphasizing that you need to strike that balance between your worldly pursuit and your spiritual pursuit.
Exactly.
It is not like spirituality is as important as worldly. Spirituality is all important, but that does not translate as giving up your worldly pursuits completely, where you sublimate your worldly pursuits,
exactly,
through, yeah, the spiritual pursuit.
It should dovetail with your spiritual goals, the final,
right,
like whatever you undertake. Swami says that that's the final message, while also emphasizing the role of money. Towards the end of the discourse, Swami speaks about how dishonest money is not going to stay,
exactly,
with you very long. And hence the emphasis on that, when you, whatever worldly pursuits you are undertaking, make sure that it ultimately leads to the Godhead.
Right.
And so that is a very, essentially the message of the Ishavasya Upanishad,
right,
that you must have strike a balance between your spiritual and the worldly pursuits. And
right,
how earlier we spoke about paravidya, aparavidya, like all of it, I think Swami finally summarizes this and leaves the students and all of us with that very emphatic message that you don't sacrifice one for the other.
Right.
All of them, they have to go hand in hand.
Right. Yeah. I think that is really the end of this series. It's the last discourse that we heard. Thank you, Hari, for the long journey. I think it's, as we mentioned last time, 21 months we've been through this. Though they are not here, a big thank you to Brother Pradeep, who was there with us during some of those complex discourses which we did not have familiarity with. His presence was very, very helpful. But it's been wonderful to go through again a beautiful and very, very profound series that Swami has given. Once again, thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. Thank you. Because of you, we also had the opportunity to go through this.
Exactly. That's just the thing that I wanted to, that our gratitude actually should go out to Swami as well as to the listeners who gave us this opportunity.
Absolutely.
I do not think that we would have gained so much insights
right.
had we not been accountable to the listeners that
right.
that every time we speak, we should speak after analyzing or studying the discourses and as well as studying a lot of other things, whatever small points that came up, like reading up on different philosophers, what they had to say, different
exactly.
streams of thought. It was like a real yajna throughout. You know, so.
Absolutely. And it's really fulfilling to be at the end of it and to be able to offer it to Swami. It's certainly not perfect, but I think we can at least say we tried our best.
Yeah.
And we hope that we will do better every time we have the opportunity. And we most humbly offer this entire series at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you all, listeners.
Because I want to say that when we say we are humbly offering it to Swami, those are not empty words, because I recall there's one, we had also mentioned this during one of the episodes, that at one stage, 1 hour before this particular program, I had been trying to read it for 2 days, the discourse, mm-hmm. and try to find resources about it, and I could not find that Hiranyagarbha, Virat and
right.
Avyakrita. I was totally lost and I didn't know what I would do. Just 1 hour, just before that, suddenly out of the blue, I happened on these particular terms somewhere. Mm-hmm. I had lost hope and simply going through, suddenly I stumbled upon these terms. So there, if this program has happened, if we were able to speak, it was because of Swami and there's no other
right.
Power that enabled it.
Definitely. And I mean, how many times we can thank Swami for allowing us to record these discourses. It's one thing to hear it from people who have heard it and who have recorded it, but to hear it in Swami's own voice, I think that is probably the highlight of this program, the ability to listen to Swami, slowly imbibe and slowly assimilate what Swami has said. I think that is what is the essence of this program, to hear it in Swami's voice, to hear it slowly, to hear it in small parts, and to slowly digest it. And we can only pray that Swami, that Nididhyasanam happens, and we don't stop this process, but the program ends, but the we should all go back to Swami's discourses again and again and again, and till the point where it becomes a part of us. We do hope that Swami gives us the inspiration to do that. Thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. In a short while from now, the other program, the last program of the day, is going to continue. Sorry, we took a little longer than usual. We started a bit late too, but we had to complete the summary today, because from the next week, as I had announced in the morning, there's going to be a change of schedule for a little bit. One of the morning programs, the answering booth, will come at 7:30. At 11 o'clock, instead of the answering booth, we'll have the Ashtotram program. At 11:30, we'll have Bishu coming to you with the program Outside Inside, Deep Inside. It's been a wonderful journey. Thank you all for being companions in this journey with myself and Hari. On behalf of Sai Prakash too, who is not here with us, we thank you for that, and we most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
single story of His infinite glory. Captured through divine discourses, music, bhajans, and through Vedas, talk shows, interviews, panel discussion, and study circles. All brought to you live from the epicenter of our times, Prashanti Nilayam, India. Radio Sai Thursday Live.